Okay. And our next speaker is Nadav Drucker, and he will also tell us about the quark anti-quark potential in N=4 super young mills.
Good. So I would like to thank the organizers for this opportunity to talk here. I spoke already a few times at these integrability meetings. This is the first time that I wrote a paper with a TBA and stuff like that, and so I feel that I finally, I'm finally a card-carrying member of the integrability club. I even understand some of the symbols on this knife. So I will tell you about this paper that I wrote, which came on the same day as Diego's paper with Amit and Juan. And I will also talk about a previous paper I wrote with Valentina, who is somewhere there. So the potential between charged particles is a very important question in any field theory. And in gauge theory, it's captured by a long rectangular Wilson loops, or in the when it's very, very long, we just consider it as anti-parallel lines. And the same quantity exists in N=4 super young mills. And it, and there we don't have quarks. We have W bosons. And that's what this quantity calculates. So this quantity was calculated in at weak coupling. The answer at leading order is this. Then when you go to second order in perturbation theory, you get this answer, which is a little bit confusing because it's not conformal, but there are infrared divergences that arise because of the infinite lines, and once you resum a subset of all higher order graphs, you can replace it by a function of the coupling. So this is sort of the second loop answer, but includes higher loop answers. Then at strong coupling, this quantity was calculated at leading order, the classical calculation, by Maldacena, which is probably the first honest calculation in ADS-CFT, which he did, Maldacena and independently Ray and Yi did half a year after the discovery of the ADS-CFT correspondence. I think this is the first really new result that appeared, and then it took a long, long, long time to get the first quantum correction, which is was finally put in analytic form by Valentina, but the analytic form is messy, so I wrote it like this. Now, recently, the O lambda cubed result was calculated, but in any case, if you stare at these numbers, you can stare as long as you want, and you don't know how to guess how to interpolate from one to the other. So that's really a problem, and we want to find an exact answer. So how do we do that? And shouldn't integrability allow us to get this quantity, at least in the planar approximation? So as you heard in Diego's talk, the answer is yes, so I conclude here. So I will... Still, since the organizer were very nice to me and gave me all this time between now and dinner, which means I have 2.5 hours, I will tell you a few more things. So it will essentially follow the same path as Diego's talk, but there were a few points that I will emphasize that he didn't and a few points that he emphasized that I didn't, so please try to stay up for these 2.5 hours. So I will start with talking about Wilson loops in general and explain more this relation between the parallel lines and the cusp anomalous dimension and why this is an interesting quantity to calculate. It is also very it's very good to understand this setup because this problem could have been solved many years ago. There were very few new technical details. There were some technical details that had to be resolved in this project and also in previous work that happened recently. But the whole idea of being able to calculate the quark-antiquark potential from an open spin chain from a spin chain model, was not realized, and this was the new realization. And we needed to do two things to do it. We needed to relate the cusp to the limit when it becomes parallel lines. So we have to understand. The first thing we had to do is introduce this extra cusp anomalous dimension and a generalization of the original problem. And the second generalization was to introduce a local operator at the cusp. And that's when you see the spin chain model, because at the end, we want to take this local insertion away, but we can see the spin chain only when this operator is there. So if you hope to find integrability in other models, this may be an inspiration on how to do it. So I will explain that, and then I will explain the model, which will follow very closely Diego's outline. So a Wilson loop in general, not in n equals 4, is this holonomy, and we want to calculate its quantum expectation value if the theory is if the Wilson loop extended along a long time t, you expect the expectation value to be proportional to t here in the exponent, and then you have this function v, which in our case will be conformal and will behave like 1 over L. Of course, I hope I could have said something about a confining theory, but I cannot. Now, there are UV divergences, which are not very interesting. In the case of the two parallel lines, there are also IR divergences. These things were the things that gave me the non-conformal behavior at two-loop order, and it's rather subtle. So it's simple to control normal logarithmic divergences, so to consider a cusp. So consider a Wilson loop with this shape. If I will work in Euclidean space like Diego did, but we can always analytically continue to Minkowski space if you want to calculate a Lorentzian cusp or take the limit for the null cusp. Now, by a conformal transformation, if the theory is conformal, this would be equivalent to mapping the point at infinity to a finite distance. Then all these straight lines become arcs. So I preserved here the angles and the colors. So the straight line becomes a circle, and all the other lines are made out of two arcs meeting at a point. This picture is not useful for calculations, but it's useful for conceptual issues. So here the Wilson loop is compact, so there is no issue of gauge invariance of an open Wilson loop, so you know that what I'm doing is completely kosher. Well, as I said, if it's conformal, this would be equivalent to the previous calculation. If it's not, if the theory is not conformal, still the behavior near the cusp is always universal. So it doesn't matter what the shape of the line exactly is. So the contribution from the cusps will be the same. So the notation is the same as in Diego's talk. Phi equals 0 is a straight line. Phi going to pi is the anti-parallel line limit. Here you can see it very, very clearly. If I keep this distance fixed, I have start here with a radius 1. When this angle becomes very sharp, that means phi, which is the complementary angle, goes to pi, these two lines become anti-parallel to each other. So in this way, this limit is very clear. And there is another advantage of this, that this looks like a two-point function. You have here two marked points on the plane. Usually when you have two local operators in a conformal theory, you know that you have a word identity that will tell you that the two-point function will behave like 1 over the distance to some power. And you call this power twice the anomalous dimension. The same exact thing is true here. The expectation value of this Wilson loop will scale in this following way. There will be a number on top, which I'm not going to be concerned about. I'm just going to be concerned about this scaling, which arises from this singularity here. And it will be exactly proportional to this distance over there. There is another picture we can use, which was also in Diego's talk. If we start from the original cusp in the plane and do a look at it in radial quantization, we get a pair of antiparallel lines on S3 cross R. And again, if you take the limit of the two lines approaching each other, the angle being very, very sharp, locally you will not see the curvature, and what you are calculating is the quark-antiquark potential. This is something Diego also said, the relation between the time here and the cutoffs in flat space. And the potential here between the quarks is the same as delta, the anomalous dimension of in my previous calculation. So the quark-antiquark potential, this generalization to S3, is the same as the cusp anomalous dimension. Now, if we are in this setup that it's conformal, so everything is equivalent, all the calculations are equivalent to each other, and you take phi to pi, what you're going to get is that this potential will have a residue, will have a divergence, because you have here two infinite lines at zero distance from each other, or the cusp completely falls onto each other, so you get a new extra divergence, and the residue will be the usual, what we call the quark-antiquark potential. So in the rest of the talk, I will essentially ignore the original problem, which of the parallel lines in flat space. I know how to recover it from here by taking this limit, and this limit is subtle. There is an extra divergence. So, but it's completely well-defined. Another thing is, once we know the contribution from a cusp, this cusp, if you take a very complicated Wilson loop which has any number of cusps in it, all the divergences are captured by the divergence of the infinite simple cusp, and you can renormalize your Wilson loop and define finite observable. So that is something nice. That's another reason we need this quantity for general angles. So that was one way to get logarithmic divergences if you have a Wilson loop. There is another way to get logarithmic divergences, and if you have a marked point along the Wilson loop by putting operators into it. So to be very specific, let me look at an infinite straight line going along the horizontal axis, and at the origin I put in a word. It's not a gauge invariant local operator. It's an adjoint valued local operator. So here it's all inside this magical path tracing symbol that makes it gauge invariant. To be more specific, you have this open Wilson line that goes from minus infinity to zero. Then you have this adjoint valued operator, and then you have this operator to the right. Continuing, make it gauge invariant, and I'm ignoring now the issue at infinity. You can always compactify it. So this can be any adjoint operator, and of course for n equals 4, we have the scalar fields, and the most natural thing to take is the BMN ground state, z to the j, as our insertion. And as usual, if you have two insertions into a straight Wilson line, you have two marked points, the word identity will dictate this kind of behavior, so we're calculating again a conformal dimension. Of course, what we're going to do is a combination of these two things. So we're going to take a line with a cusp and an operator sitting on top of the cusp. That's the most general way to calculate a Wilson loop, which just has, and just study the logarithmic divergences or anomalous dimensions. So this was actually quite general, even though I'm focusing on n equals 4. In the case of n equals 4, what is new is that we have this extra angle that Diego mentioned, so we couple to a scalar. Now we have these two straight lines or two arcs. We had this discontinuity of the tangent vector. We might as well introduce a discontinuity of n as well. So we along each line, each ray, we have a different one, and the angle between them is what we call theta. So this is one scalar coupling along one ray. This is the other scalar coupling along the other ray. And the crucial point, and this is what we noticed in my first paper with Valentina, is that the calculation of this generalized quark-antiquark potential is not harder than in the case of the anti-parallel lines. So we could calculate it at weak coupling and we could calculate it at strong coupling, and that's what we indeed did. So I will go over this calculation. So just to make notations, we have a weak coupling expansion, where this is the loop order, and we have an ADS expansion, where this is the loop order, and of course at the end, we want these two quantities to interpolate from one to the other. So, to offend all the people here who do high loop integrals, I will do a one loop integral. And this you can do in one transparency, and I can do it in full detail. So I have this Wilson loop with this angle here, which is pi minus phi. I have this line, which can be an exchange of either a gluon or a scalar. It can also exchange between the line and itself, but then there is exact cancellation between the gluon and the scalar. So, at linear order in lambda, the expectation value of the Wilson loop is the double integral of this is on one ray, that's on this ray, this guy is on the other ray, and now I take the expectation value, I take the propagator for simplicity in the Feynman gauge, this should be a nu here, and I get the dot product between these two tangent vectors, and I get the dot product between these two scalar directions divided by the distance squared, then you use some trigonometry, you get this. And very basic identities will tell you, well, this is just this. You extract out a sine phi, and then you do this integral, and you discover some kind of logarithm or arc cosine of phi. So you get phi, arc cosine of cosine phi, so you get back phi. And one integral is completely scale invariant, and that gives you this logarithmic divergence. So this is the answer. I derived it in full detail in one transparency, and it's very, very simple. In the rest of the talk, or in all of Diego's talk, we're going to use really, really heavy machinery, an elephant gun, to get the same answer. But of course, this elephant gun can also kill elephants and get it at any arbitrary value of the coupling. So remember the simple answer. You see, at phi equals zero and theta equals zero, this vanishes, and the pole here vanishes, but for phi equals pi, which is the anti-parallel line limit, there is a pole, and this guy diverges. Now you can go to higher loop orders, and the first thing that you see is, nice thing, are ladder graphs, which contribute to this quantity, and actually they dominate a specific funny limit. And recently they were iterated to a very high loop order, and if you heard Claude's monologue this morning about polylogs, the same harmonic polylogs appear in the iteration of this graph. It's to higher order, so it's quite a nice limit and result. But there are also interacting graphs, and they give actually a very simple answer, which without polylogs in it. Yes. Yeah. This. Well, there is one there is one thing that just goes by scale. I just scale it out, one integral. And then, the other integral just gives you arc cosine of the argument, arc cosine of cosine phi. This is just a scale, an overall scale here, and this is really, it just gives you a log or an arc cosine. There's nothing particularly interesting in this integral.
Related question, so in principle the result should be periodic in phi from the very
yes.
beginning. So it means that by doing this analytical continuation in phi, you get some excitations or something like this. You have some physical interpretation of what does this quantity compute if you go over to pi?
I don't have an interpretation. It has always a pole at pi, so you're passing through a pole when you have... when you do this. I don't know what is the meaning of the analytic continuation.
It's the same as the amplitudes. It's the same discontinuities for scattering amplitudes computed by gluon going on shell mm-hmm. being exchanged.
Okay, so that was perturbation theory. Let me go briefly into the string picture, which is also very useful to understand what we want to do. Here it's good to look at this picture of S3 cross R. Now ADS fills in this S3, and this is what we calculate with this generalized quark-antiquark potential. We need to find a string minimal surface that spans these two lines. And, well, this can be done exactly. You write a metric for the space. You can just solve. Everything is given in terms of elliptic functions. And the theta and phi are all elliptic functions of some parameters, and you have the elliptic modulus and all these things you love. And the action is also given by a complete elliptic integral, and then you need to solve this transcendental equation, and you have the action, which is the potential at strong coupling, as a function of these angles. And that's in general, but you can expand it for small theta and phi and get an analytic result. Again, small theta and phi is not the limit we want. In principle, we want the limit of phi equals pi, but we are concentrating on arbitrary phi and theta, and then we have the simpler limit. You can also go to one loop, which is what I did with Valentina, and it's a very tedious calculation. The important point is, because we had elliptic functions, now we're going to find differential operators, which are all of Lamé form. It's a non-trivial fact, but it's related to the fact that we have elliptic functions. But the fact that they end up exactly as Lamé operators is a bit mysterious, but we are able to find their exact spectrum. So you get these kinds of determinants, which you can calculate, at least numerically, but, well, these are all analytic expressions. Quite nasty, and this is the final answer for the one loop potential. And again, if I expand it at small phi and theta, so this is for theta equals zero, non-zero but small phi, all these elliptic functions become trigonometric functions, and then I can do the integral exactly, and I get these types of zeta values.
The one loop determinant for any for theta different from zero too?
For theta different from zero, but phi equals zero. The general case of phi and theta, both different from zero, requires a matrix generalization of the Lamé operator, which we have not figured out. Just as a check, we can take the phi going to pi limit to see that we recover the usual quark-antiquark potential. Yes, Pedro.
Can I just ask something about it? The first term, can you compare with the result of localization?
This term?
Yes.
Yes.
It agrees?
Yes.
It's okay. Okay, thank you.
Well, they compared it. I didn't. They say it agrees. So if you take the phi going to pi limit, you get it and you find at weak coupling a very particular regularization of this log divergence that we found that there is at two loops. But you can take theta to zero and you get the exact usual answer. The same thing at strong coupling, so we recover this whole behavior. So then there is your question. At small phi and theta, we found these two terms, these at weak coupling, these at strong coupling. You see they are all nice rational numbers. And we thought there should be a simplification for this quantity in this limit. And this is indeed what Diego said, that they were able to relate it to this expectation value, a deformation of the circular Wilson loop, which is also supersymmetric and allows you to get an exact result also beyond the planar approximation. And if you hold off to the liquor tonight, you will be able to get up tomorrow and hear Kolya discuss this limit in more detail. So far I did not mention integrability. I gave you explicit results for cusped Wilson loops, and now I want to use the tools of integrability to calculate them, so I need to find a spin chain and solve it. So the idea is to allow, on top of what I did before, an extra insertion, and then do everything, solve the model, and then at the end remove the insertion. Then we also have to remember about this angle, because if we start with a straight line and remove the insertion, we get just end up with a half BPS operator, which is boring. Again, it's useful to see it from the string side, where I told you that before I calculated this quantity, the energy of the minimal area spanning these two lines, but here you have an open string, and with specified boundary conditions, and what we are doing in this more general question is to ask what is the spectrum of excitations of this open string. So we allow this string to wiggle in an arbitrary way, and we want to find the full spectrum of all the states that live with the same boundary conditions here as they had here, and then we can consider just the ground state energy at the end. So the simplest insertion is z to the j. And now the first thing to notice is if you have a string living on this, if you have this string picture and you have some excitation of this string, this excitation is just propagating along a string in the middle of ADS. It does not know that this string ends on the boundary. So it will behave exactly, if it meets another excitation along the string, it will pass through it as if it's on a closed string. So this tells you that everything that happens in the bulk of the string world sheet is the same as usual. The only thing you need to worry about is when this magnon hits the boundary, it sees a boundary and gets reflected, so you need to worry about a reflection matrix. So you can see the same thing from the gauge theory picture, where you have this operator z. It has a beginning and an end, because it's an adjoint value word. It's not a local gauge invariant operator. This side connects to this line. This side connects to that line. And I put here this one magnon y in it. This y will travel along and just see the z here, the z here, the z here, until it gets to the end. And then it discovers that it's inside a Wilson line. Before that, it didn't know about that. So let's do some heuristic Feynman diagrams. Concretely, I take here an operator with five fields, let's say five scalar fields. So at tree level, I need to contract all of them just to saturate all the fields. So this is the tree level graph. This tells you that this operator will have classical dimension 5. This will behave like this distance over 1 over this distance to the 10th power at tree level. Then at one loop you have this interaction. So for example, these two guys can talk to each other, the usual quartic interaction of n equals 4 superring mills.
and it's an exchange interaction, but this does not know anything about the Wilson loops. Except the last guy, it will know about the Wilson loop and it can interact with it. Or the last guy here can talk with the Wilson loop and interact with it. So this tells us that the Hamiltonian, the Bohm-Hamiltonian one loop is the same as Minhans-Rembo spin chain, or more generally, if we go to arbitrary loop order, we're going to have an S matrix, which is the usual Bicert S matrix, which carries in two representations of SU2/2. And there is a boundary interaction that we have to study separately. This still doesn't know about the angle that appears here. To see this angle, you actually need to communicate all the way across the entire spin chain from one side to the other. And that tells you that in this case of the operator of dimension, of classical dimension 5, the angle will show up at 6 loop order, generically at g to the 2j plus 1. Of course, if we take j to be equal, oh, that was L in Diego's talk, if we take it to be equal to 0, this happens at order g squared. There is no spin chain. There is a direct interaction between one Wilson loop, between one arc and the other.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So at the end, you want to get rid of all these lines in between, right?
Yes.
So there is nothing left from the... as from the bulk vertices. So how comes that your equation still remember about the S matrix and...
Does my equation remember the S matrix? I don't know if it does. There won't be any scattering at the end. All I have is the reflection of the boundaries. At the end, it's the same Y system, if you want, as that is always there, which is related to the full symmetry of the theory. So, this scattering will not show up at all in the final calculation. I'm never going to use this scattering. I'm just using it in the derivation, but in the final result, I don't think it's there. So, we need to calculate the boundary reflection matrix, and again we can use symmetry, as Diego said, I will repeat it. So the full symmetry of the theory is this, PSU2,2/4. The usual BMN vacuum, trace edge of the J, breaks it to this, two copies of PSU2/2, so our magnons will be our bulk magnons will be representations of this. A single boundary breaks it to this algebra. And the intersection of this and this is one copy of PSU2/2, the diagonal copy. So there was this picture before. I don't really need to explain it. This version of... Adobe doesn't like some of my letters, so you're going to have to guess what they are. But these are the two indices of this magnon that now I split. And now it's split into a magnon carrying one index and momentum P. And I guess this is a minus P, and I didn't write the index, the label of the spin. So this is PP minus P minus P. So we always have these two pictures. And here I wrote down the crossing equation, which was explained by Diego. I don't need to mention that. And there is a solution. And again, a crucial fact is that this solution will have this factor that once you cross over, you get this function that has a poles for all bound state numbers, as you will see in a bit. So far I talked only about the right boundary. We also need to introduce a left boundary, but if we want the two Wilson loops to be at an angle, the same story will happen there, that you're going to take a copy and break it to a diagonal subgroup, but it doesn't have to be the same diagonal subgroup. So to go from this subgroup, you can take one of, so I had a diagonal one before, now I have a diagonal prime. If I conjugate this PSU2 by a twist matrix, which I write here, then I will get this D prime. So that is the difference. Every time I reflect from the left matrix, I before that and after that have to conjugate my state or my reflection matrix by this matrix. This theta and phi are exactly the same as the ones I discussed at the beginning. This is the angle in space, and this is the flavor angle relating the two rays of my Wilson loop. So just to write in graphical form the Beta-Ansatz equation, we start with two magnons, say. If I take this magnon, take it all the way to the right, reflect it, scatter it again, take it all the way to the left, conjugate it by that, and reflect, and come back to myself, I have to get back to the original picture. So that is in this picture. And in the doubled picture, I take all the purple lines, I put them on the right. So I take this guy, I take it over here, I take this guy, and I take it over there. And, I said this wrong. I take this guy, I take it over here, and here it's periodic, so it goes back to here. I take this guy, it goes all the way to the left, here it's periodic, and it goes back to there. And at these two points, there is a scattering matrix. There is a scattering matrix, and at this point there is a scattering matrix and a twist. An important fact to make things work is that all these scattering matrices, apart for this twist, which commutes with it, and scalar factors, are the same. So here we have the scattering matrix of PSU2/2 left. Here we have the scattering matrix of PSU2/2 right, but these two are fixed by symmetry, as was shown by Bysert, and in the original picture we always scatter the left indices with the right indices, so that's what happens here. There's always a pair of scatterings. And this reflection from the boundary, because it's also, the symmetry is PSU2/2, it's also the same reflection matrix. So these are all the same reflection matrices up to a different scalar phase here and different scalar phase here and a commuting twist. So this is very important in the derivation of what I'm doing now, but I don't want to calculate the asymptotic beta ansatz, which will be valid when this spin chain is very, very large. I want actually to consider the case where this distance between the walls goes to zero. That is the case of J equals zero, or L in Diego's notation. So I will not write down the TBA equations. Diego went over it. It's very much the usual TBA equations with extra chemical potentials and a driving term that comes from the boundary dressing phase. And the Y system equations are unmodified by the analytic properties of the Y functions. And their asymptotics are different. Yes. I think they are different. So the question was whether the discontinuity conditions on the Y function are the same or different. So I assume that they are different. They are different. They have different analytic structures. They are the same? Okay. Okay, go on, argue.
There are just some extra poles at IA, and that's it, I think.
Yeah, the analysis should be, but it's Did you check this?
They just follow from the evaluation terms, so they cannot be the same because you have the same kernels. You have the same kernels in the TBA equations, okay. And these kernels determine the jump discontinuity.
But the driving
conditions.
Term?
Driving term can produce extra poles, basically.
Okay.
Without the cats, it's quite clear that the Y system is the same as a whole in relativistic with boundary. Here, there is the tricky fact that the Y system should be completed with the extra discontinuity equation. This is why I asked. But basically, as Sergei was mentioning, this is fixed by the bulk dressing factor. So maybe they should be the same.
So if you divide by asymptotic solutions, then the equations are exactly the same. So the only difference is the asymptotic solution, and it has very similar analytical properties.
It's a good thing I have 2 hours and a half. Right?
I have the bell.
Continue. To know. I thought everybody is supposed to turn off their cell phones and their cowbells before the talk.
No cowbells.
Okay. So I will go over again very quickly the derivation of the Luescher correction. And the way I will do it is it's equivalent, but I'm not going to look at the asymptotic solution of the Y. Of the TPA equation, I will instead calculate a transfer matrix. So this is the double row transfer matrix that you would usually get in the case of an open spin chain. So you take this pair of magnons, well, this magnon carrying two indices around like that, or in the doubled picture, you have this guy. And now a nice trick happens because all these this reflection is the same as a scattering. You have here three scatterings. You can act with a Young-Buxter equation and move this scattering here, and then you can move the scattering here, and then you can cancel it again, this scattering, and you just get this picture, where you have a pair of two virtual magnons, each carrying just one representation of a PSU2/2, they scatter against these two physical magnons, which I will soon take away anyhow. And the only thing that happens is that at this boundary, they get twisted. So what we get is a product of two twisted PSU2/2 transfer matrices. That is the full double row transfer matrix. Maybe this is a question to an answer to the sign question. Because when you want to look at a single particle state, you have a, so when you just send one particle through, maybe you it should be the same, you know, it's not exactly the same, maybe it should just be the same as this, so it should be a transfer matrix of just a single PSU2/2, which comes out with a correct sign, with the alternating signs. So anyhow, for the Z to the J vacuum, you don't have any scatterings. So you just have these reflections, and this is what the transformator is. It's just a reflection and another reflection. And as I showed in the last transparency, these reflection matrices completely cancel out, and you just get the scalar factor out of these reflection matrices, and then the trace of the twist matrix squared. The twist in PSU2/2, I have two copies of them, so it's the square. So I get this factor, and then there was this expression already, the Luescher formula that Diego wrote, and essentially what we get, because there is a pole in T, we get the square root of this. Q is the bound state number, and we need to sum over Q. So here using this square root and choosing these signs, but as I said, these signs agree with the sign of a single supertrace here. You get this function. This is some powers of Q that come from the exact boundary dressing phase, and you do the sum, you find some Pauli logarithms that indeed simplify to a Bernoulli polynomials, And in the simple case of j equals 0, the minimal length spin chain, what you get is just Li1, which is log. So you get the original answer. So Kostya, when I told him this at first, he told me that this is the hardest way to calculate a free Coulomb potential. It probably is. But of course, this system of equation is much more powerful. So this exactly agrees with the one loop answer from field theory. So to summarize, my first generalization involved a two-parameter family of Wilson loops that was introducing the cusp. So instead of calculating two parallel lines, I take the cusps. It's as complicated or easier than the original problem, and it includes it as a limit. And it's interesting in its own right. The second generalization meant to insert any arbitrary adjoint valued word. So we get an open spin chain model, and this open spin chain ended up being very, very simple because of this fact that we could completely undo the matrix structure of the reflection matrix. When we calculated the transfer matrix or something like that, so it can be completely, it could be diagonalized, the boundary reflection. So as a conclusion, the answer at the end is we find a very, very similar question to the one of the spectral problem. It was not clear at all a year ago that calculating a quark antiquark potential is the same question as the, is so similar to the spectral problem, and it's really, it must be a very deep fact about n equals 4 that it's the same Y system that comes out. There are some technical things that are interesting. For Konishi, wrapping starts at 4 loop. In this case, wrapping starts at 1 loop, so that is why this complicated, in the case of the Konishi, it was the integrability calculation that was easy and the perturbative calculation that was hard. Here it was the opposite, but it's because it starts at one loop. And of course, this immediately allows you to be able, Diego Amit and Malasena did, to iterate it to third loop order and effectively calculate triple wrapping, which you cannot do for the Konishi, and compare it to explicit field theory results. So if people are worried about something interesting happening to Konishi at double wrapping, well, don't worry about Konishi, do it here, and nothing interesting happens. This exact matching was done. If you want to introduce a Z, you can also do that. It's going to be a little bit higher order in perturbation theory. And we've sort of, to a large part, ended the spectral problem and are happy that we know how to calculate things, at least in principle. There are some details, but there are be other systems that are also physically interesting and are worth exploring. So finally, a year ago when I talked about my paper in Valentina, who really pushed me in this direction, I was asking whether we are ever going to be able to get this answer out of field theory, and it felt like very premature to say it, but the answer is almost yes, because we calculated not this quantity from field theory, but we calculated the field theory answer from string theory, essentially, from Worldcheek technique, so we are very close to this, and I assume that next year somebody will talk about this in Utrecht. So thank you.
So we've had some questions, but any more?
About your one-loop calculation, maybe it's rather a question for your collaborator. Do you know why, whereas for the spectral problem, for a similar calculation, a folder string, it was actually very crucial to introduce L, the length, finite length, for regularization, otherwise you get some nasty log twos, which would never match anything. Whereas here it seems it agrees with some reasonable results.
I'm trying to work on this relation. It's not clear yet how this log two enter.
Yeah, but why here it doesn't enter?
So once I work out the analytic continuation properly, then I can answer.
Yeah. As a continuation of this question, so in
when the microphone.
Begin, Valentina could answer. So when you compute these determinants, the starting point is some small fluctuations of this flux tube solution. Do they have a meaning in terms of this reflection matrices or how to describe them using this beta equations, for instance?
I don't think so. So this is the full system of the quark-anti-quark potential. So this involves already the interaction of the two boundaries. To relate it to the boundary dressing phase or something like that, you can do it at the classical. So you can look at a solution which has a large a Wilson loop with a cusp and a z to the j, and take j to be large, and you can find a classical solution describing this system. And then you can look at that near one boundary, and I think that will isolate one boundary contribution. So
suppose I take this anti-parallel lines on the sphere, and then I consider a small fluctuation of the string that, for instance, runs from one boundary to another and reflects from it. So is it possible to describe it within this framework?
Yes, so that would be a magnon on top of this solution, and I would start by putting it on a large, in the asymptotic limit, large J limit, and study this magnon and how this magnon comes and hits a single boundary, rather than immediately start it with a double boundary. But I think it should be doable, better in the large.
Maybe an indirect answer would come easier from the algebraic curve approach. Once, I don't know, Yannick last terms are more clear at one loop. So I'm talking about using integrability via algebraic curves, but the way it was proposed recently by Yannick, maybe it's not a direct answer. And it's just complementary. Maybe it's easier to see that there fluctuations as cat, so the Gromov-Viera solution to the problem, maybe.
Okay, last question.
Yeah. So actually, it's not my question. Amit sent me by SMS. Why do you consider Z to the L insertions but not X to the L, which looks like it will preserve more symmetries?
Yes, so, okay, you have to say here what X and what Z is, but, so let me explain a little bit, if the question wasn't clear. When I wrote here Z to the J, this Z was orthogonal to both the scalar fields, phi 1 and phi 2, appearing in the Wilson loop itself. And if you take the ground state x, say, which is x1 plus ix2, then you get a complicated mixing between the... this is not a nice ground state. It's not supersymmetric. It has more symmetry. It has SO5 symmetry in the case of the straight line. But in the case of the straight line with one insertion, it's not supersymmetric. So I do not know that it's a ground state, that it's a solution of the beta ansatz equation. Sorry? So it's not a supersymmetric state, and I don't know that it's a ground state. I don't know that it solves the beta equations.